Hi, so this is Stu Holliday. Welcome to the Focus Mind podcast. With me today is elite running coach Ben Rosario. Ben, would you just like to say hello to everyone out there?
Hello, everyone out there.
This is unique for me. This is the first time since the pandemic I've actually been able to do a face-to-face, and it feels really good. And it feels really good as well because I'm actually in Ben's office in Flagstaff, Arizona. I've made it over to see family and also catch up with a few running people that I know in this part of the world. But we're here to talk about Ben, not me. I will get Ben to talk about his current role as the executive director and head coach of the North Arizona Elite. But he actually was an athlete till about 2010 when he retired. And then he spent around 6 or 7 years running running shoe stores in St. Louis, Missouri, before he came out here to Flagstaff. And the purpose of today's interview is for us to be able to have a very easy conversation about running, and in particular about the mental aspects of running. Focus is something that is at the center of my work and at the center of his, with his athletes and team. And I just wanted to start the conversation by asking Ben, going back to his days as an athlete, how good was your focus?
Well, I think that people sometimes confuse focus with passion. My passion was very high. I think my focus at times was on the wrong things. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that I think I was very good at as a very young athlete, I mean, we're talking the very beginning, 7th grade, 8th grade, I sort of let my passion overwhelm me, and I focused on goals in an unhealthy way. And I got away from what I really loved about running when I first started, which was just simply competing and trying to beat people and trying to go as hard as I could. I loved that when I was a kid, but as you get into that high school age, college, university, it's such an interesting sport, and all sports are like this, but I do think there's this cult nature of running where you follow everybody's times and you put these people on a pedestal and you put these certain times and performances on a pedestal, and if you don't achieve these things, then all of a sudden your self-worth isn't where it should be, and you attach your self-worth, is what I'm saying, to these arbitrary times. And I think I started focusing on that a lot in high school and a lot in college, and it really wasn't until probably after I left, I went to the Hanson's Brooks team after college and ran there for 2 years and had a great time, and it was incredibly valuable, and 2 years I would never do any differently. But when I left there and went back to my hometown and was still running hard, but I had other things in my life, all of a sudden my focus as far as my running goes, I think, was healthier and better because I was back to focusing on just running as hard as I could, because running was no longer the only thing in my life as I saw it. In fact, it took a different place. It had a different place in my life on my list of priorities. And then I just went back to racing like when I was a kid. And my focus was great because I focused on it when I was doing it. But when I wasn't doing it, I was focusing on whatever I was doing. And at that time, it was running my business. As you said at the top, I owned running stores in St. Louis, and that took up a tremendous amount of my time. And so I had no time to focus on running except when I was running. And I think, I don't know if that's what you're asking, but for me, that's how I see my focus in my own running. It was much better when I had a healthier outlook on where running really needed to be in my life.
Well, that's a really nice segue into our shared philosophy. We don't have completely the same things, but there are a number of touch points where we agree in our practice. We've been having a small conversation before we got started today. And for me, I love sharing knowledge and skills with everyone. And the ethos behind the North Arizona Elite is to almost demystify an elite running team and their practice, as evidenced by the book that he's written with Matt Fitzgerald, which came out last week. Run Like a Pro, Even If You Go Slow. And in that book, Matt Fitzgerald came and ran with Ben up here in Flagstaff for 16 weeks.
Yeah, he was here for a few months, yeah.
Yeah, and he basically ate the same dog food that all the other runners had to, whether that was sessions, strength and conditioning, nutrition. He followed what the elites did in order to be able to put in a performance best at the Chicago Marathon in what year?
2017 was the year he was here.
Yeah. So you can see from the way in which Ben did that with Matt, and also in his other well-known book, Inside a Marathon, which was the story of Scott Forbull's journey to seventh place in
New York City.
And in that book, it's a brilliant coach-athlete relationship on page, talking about Ben's perspective, talking about Scott's perspective, and seeing where there was, you could read through it the underlying relationship between them, and encouraging, nurturing, and development of Scott from Ben, but then also for himself in order to be able to put in that performance. So what I'm trying to get to there is the shared next level is coach-athlete relationship. It's really crucial in the work that I do. I'm supporting coaches, I'm supporting athletes, and in Ben's case, he's trying to develop a better working relationship with all of his athletes, and that leads to having good culture. So I'd be interested, whilst we're here talking about where we're aligned, what for you are the tenets that make a really good culture amongst a run team or squad of athletes?
I think that you, first of all, can't just say what your culture is. You have to live it, and then you have to define what it is based on truly what it has become. Mm-hmm. I think people make a mistake when they, on the first day of meeting a group of athletes, they say, this is our culture. Mm-hmm. Well, how could you possibly know? Your culture is a living thing. And one thing we did that I think was really healthy is we were around for a good 4 or 5 years before we actually sat down and had a meeting and defined our culture and wrote it down on paper. And it was really the athletes just saying, hey, this is how we do this, this is how we do this, this is how we treat one another, this is how we treat our fans, this is our culture. And it was based on fact. It was based on what had been going on for the last 5 years in the group. And I think for us, it's important to trust one another, to respect one another, to believe that we make one another better. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of our core tenets. I think that living in what we call optimistic reality is one of our core tenets. What I just talked about with my own mistakes and focusing too much on arbitrary goals and times, I think we're just trying to get better here. You know, these athletes are already pretty darn good. So if we just get better, we're going to produce some great results as a byproduct of just getting better. And then you don't put any limits on yourself either. You know, because sometimes an arbitrary goal can be limiting. Who knows? Maybe you could go faster than you think. So we just train and we just try to get better and we just race. And I think, you know, I think there are a couple other things about culture I would say. I would say that you need to be thinking about it. It needs to be front of mind for the leader of an organization. Almost at all times. You have to have a beat on it. You know, is the culture good? Is it healthy? Is it positive right now? And if you find it in a negative spot, and it will be, it will ebb and flow, you've got to address it, because it can go in a negative spiral, and that's hard to get out of when you get too far down. And so, I just think it's keeping an eye on it, it's being aware of it, and it's acknowledging that it will change over time based on your personnel.
It sounds like the way that you've described it being front and center, it's a huge focus for you.
That's
like, I was going to ask you, what are your focuses or foci as a head coach compared to when you're an athlete and you're chasing times and potentially unhealthy goals? As a coach, your focus is on your group of athletes, but you could look at them and you could just look at their times, you could look at their output, their wattage, their weight, whatever it might be, these measures. But it feels like one of the most crucial things for you is, how are these guys getting on? How are they showing up to work with the culture that I and my team are embedding?
Yes, I mean, that's one of the reasons I go to practice every day. I mean, logistically, there's no need for me to be at a run where they're just going to meet and run 10 miles together easy. But I like to go and see how they're doing and check in and have a couple laughs with them before they head out on their run. And it helps me see, hey, how are they doing? Did anybody seem off today? Did anybody seem down today? Mm-hmm. Or did the group seem positive? Were they jovial? Were they joking around? Those are actually really important things. Mm-hmm. Because those 10-mile easy runs together, that's bonding. Mm-hmm. That's when they get close. That's when they talk about life. And if the conversations are positive and healthy, then that's good. And the culture is moving in the right direction. If those conversations are negative or cynical or mean, then the culture's heading in the wrong direction. And you need to be there and have a beat on it to understand where it is.
How hard is it as a coach that sometimes maybe in those moments you're wanting to jump in and say something maybe, but actually maybe the right thing to do is let the athletes work something out for themselves and give them the ownership to course correct it?
I think you're absolutely right. I don't then join in on the run and monitor the conversation and manipulate the conversation. I see them for 10 minutes, I watch them activate, I send them off on their run, and then I come into the office and they take care of the rest. Mm-hmm. And I think I need them to be leaders within the, there needs to be leadership within the team. I can't be the only voice in the room, you know, creating the culture. In fact, that wouldn't be real culture. Real culture is a collective culture, and so you need everybody contributing in their own way and everybody leading in their own way. I often tell them, this isn't a matter of me trying to find the one or two leaders on the team. This is me expecting each one of you to lead in your own way. Mm. Some people lead by example. Some people lead physically. You know, they take charge in workouts. Other people are the social leaders of the team. That's an important function. And these things need to happen organically. Mm. I don't have a meeting and say, okay, you're in charge of where you guys are going to go to dinner every week. You're in charge of breakfast. You're in charge of the workouts. You're in charge. You know, I mean, those things have to happen naturally, as they would in any business or any office culture. It's not that different than any job anywhere. If you've seen the television show The Office in Great Britain or in the U.S., it's a comedy, but nonetheless, each of those characters sort of play their own role, literally in the case of a TV show, but in a real office, each person kind of has his or her contribution that they make to the collective good. Mm. And that's what a team is like.
And so with how you engender the culture, is that something that you've ever had any training in, or is it really based on your experience of having been in their shoes for Brooks Hansen when you were younger?
I think, you know, I've been on teams my whole life. I was a stick and ball sports kid growing up, and then of course I was on the cross country and track teams in high school and college. You know, I ran my business, so I had employees. I ran at the Hansen's Brooks team, or I ran for the Hansen's Brooks team, so I learned from that experience. And you just learn over time what works and what doesn't, or what you believe works and what you believe doesn't work, and you try to copy the good and get rid of the bad, and then all of a sudden you have your own culture. It's not that different than, or your own philosophy on culture. Mm. It's not that different than physiology. Mm. And how you write training. You know, you see things that you believe worked, you see things that you believe didn't work, and then all of a sudden you shape, you know, and over time, and you know, you wake up one day and you kind of have your own philosophy. Now it's the result of all these other experiences and other coaches you've worked with and other athletes you've been around, and but eventually it's your own because you took some things from here, some things from there, and you're kind of constantly, again, it's a living thing. Mm. Your training philosophy, and so is your philosophy on culture.
Got you. I see that your support team advocate focus sessions for athletes. for instance, we talked about some of the sports psych support that you get. And interestingly, as a coach, you have other people that help and support you, say with strength conditioning. But often, as my experience in the field goes, the coaches tend to say, strength and conditioning guys, get on with the strength and conditioning, make sure the guys are happy. You leave them to it, but you've got an interest. Whereas sports psychology, you've got professionals you may bring in to help and work with your athletes. But actually, as a coach, not only do you have to coach, you have to be a sports psychologist within the team as well. I just wonder, when you were an athlete, did you get much in the way of either sports psych training, maybe with things like visualization, that kind of thing? And did you ever get support from the kind of support your athletes now get?
Yeah, it's a good question, because the answer is no. back in the day, you know, I was in college in the late 90s, early 2000s. It just wasn't a thing. You know, it just wasn't something that people were doing, particularly at my level, NCAA Division II in the United States. Those programs weren't working with sports psychologists. Mm. And it wasn't even something that you thought about doing. And there was still a stigma about it, I believe, at that time, as I remember it. And so the psychology that you learned was not labeled as such, but you learned it by experiencing it. Honestly, my high school coach was phenomenal at motivation. Mm-hmm. Jim Linares, I ended up writing a book with him too about high school cross country teams. But you would run through a brick wall for him. Mm-hmm. And I think that was my first introduction into sports psychology without even knowing it. Just listening to him speak, watching him command a room, you know, having 100 boys just hanging on his every word, and the way he spoke to us and the way he motivated us, that was really my real world sports psychology lesson. And then of course I saw other ways to do it as well. Mm. You know, my college coach was very quiet. Mm. You were lucky to get a way to go. If you got a way to go, that means you ran one of your best races of all time. Otherwise, you pretty much heard nothing from him. And I'm not saying that was right, but I'm also not saying it was wrong. It was good for my development to understand that, look, you can't always, you can't overtalk. Sometimes you do have to let things happen. And guess what? You know, if an athlete ran bad, you kind of got to let them deal with it sometimes, because you tend to engage in word vomit when you're trying to explain or help an athlete through a bad race when really, you know, they kind of do need to know that they didn't run well. Mm. And so a little less talking, a little bit more pragmatism, a little more bluntness might actually be the way to go. And I think I kind of learned that from my college coach. And then my coach, Kevin Hansen, when I ran for the Hansen's Brooks team, he was probably a little bit of both. He was pretty blunt and pretty realistic. But he could also motivate. He could also pump you up. And if he told you you were ready to run well, you really believed it. And I appreciated that. And I think, or I'd like to believe, that that's where I've settled, which is that idea that, hey, I'm pretty pragmatic and pretty blunt. But if I tell you you're ready to go, I really believe it. You don't want a boy who cried wolf situation where you tell them they're ready and they don't run well. You tell them they're ready, they don't run well. Eventually, they're not going to believe you. So I try to be as honest as I possibly can.
Mm, great. And on my side of the fence with what I do working with endurance athletes, obviously, I've got quite a specialist niche. It's the mind. It's the psyche. It's sometimes more of the care side that people need. And other times, it's more specific strategy work. But that's where my bread and butter is. And when I work with coaches, I'm always keen to understand, particularly with the run coaches, knowing a number over the years, a lot of them have got in their head, there's different ways in which you can coach and emphasize certain things. And like I worked with one coach, and he was absolutely an advocate of the Maffetone method for his athletes. But what I always like to try and find out is what pillars a coach really has as their foundation. Is that something, have you got some foundational pillars that if I was an athlete coming to work with you, you would be saying, this is what I believe in? And, you know, like, you've got your actual activity, you've got your sports psych, you've got your nutrition. Or what's your mix of pillars that for you are kind of foundational for any of your athletes you work with?
you know, of course, I think physiologically I have the things that I believe in. I would say from a more overarching perspective, I think my overarching, you know, idea, if I could explain it this way, is I believe that there's four things that need to be happening in the coach-athlete relationship. Mm-hmm. The athlete has to believe in themselves. Mm-hmm. The coach has to believe in himself or herself. There has to be a lot of self-confidence on both sides of the table. Mm-hmm. If that is there, then the coach needs to believe in the athlete, and the athlete needs to believe in the coach. So all four of those things need to be happening at the same time. In my experience, when those things are happening at the same time, really good results follow. Mm. When even one of those things isn't present, it affects all of the other boxes negatively. If the athlete doesn't believe in themselves, the coach has a tough time really believing in the athlete. And here's the problem. Then the athlete can sense that. So then the athlete doesn't really believe in the coach. So all four fall apart if even one isn't working. And that's my philosophy on the coach-athlete relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking more broadly about in your, you know, for any athlete coming to work with you, of what they you would expect.
Oh, what I expect of them. Well, let me try that one.
But that's a great explanation for me as well.
But that's what it comes down to. Mm. I expect them to believe in themselves. Mm. If they believe in themselves, that's the beginning of the whole thing. Mm. I can take care of the rest because I believe in myself. Mm. And then the relationship will flow from there. But they really have to believe in themselves, and they have to believe in the idea that being a part of a team will make them better.
Yeah.
That would be what I would say to them, is you have to believe in that core tenet above all else. You have to believe that, because if you're kind of a lone wolf, or you, and this is okay if you're like this, if you sort of get jealous of people pretty easily, if they beat you, you're not going to be good in a team environment. You actually have to be happy for them if they beat you. And you have to be excited about trying to beat them the next time. Mm. But you have to be somebody who has who thrives in a group environment to be a part of the team. I really believe that.
And that's quite a tough ask. And I had this when I was working archery, because you've got athletes who are individual athletes in their sport. It's not a team sport, and yet you're using a team environment to help each of them improve. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with individual athletes, there's a problem of exactly what you're saying there. They want to be the top dog, yep. But how can you be top dog in a group?
That's right. Well, I like to believe that if you get enough high-level athletes together, they can buy into that idea, speaking of dogs, that each dog has his day. Mm. So, you look, you know, our women over the last couple of years have been a great example, because we've had these three women that have been incredibly successful in the marathon: Stephanie Bruce, Kellen Taylor, Alefine Tuliamuk. And at times, each of them has beat the other. Mm. Yeah, Steph won the national 10K title. Alefine was second. Mm. Kellen was top 10 at the New York City Marathon. Alefine was 12th. Alefine won the Olympic trials. Steph was 6th. Kellen was 8th. So they've all gone back and forth, and I think it's been healthy for them. It's been healthy for them, because if you're the best person on a team, and it's like what they say, what's the classic psychological meme that you see, where if you're in a room and you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Mm. You know, and that's what I feel about group training. You should surround yourself with people that are going to challenge you, and you should be excited about that. Mm. If you're not, you're in the total wrong place.
I'm sensing I'm finding the criteria here of if you want to join the NAS Elite, what the kind of criteria is to be involved.
I think mentally, for sure. Yeah. Mm. You got to be strong mentally, because it's not easy to get beat. Mm. And you will get your butt kicked by really good people. You'll have your day as well. But you will get beat, and you've got to be able to deal with that. But if you can't deal with it at practice, how the heck are you going to deal with it on race day? Because you're not going to win every race. Yeah. It's really hard to win a race. And so I do think that the group environment is healthy and good for athletes, and keeps them grounded in reality, which is really important. It doesn't mean you don't have huge goals, but you also have to understand that, hey, you know, this is a really tough gig. This is a really, really pretty crazy endeavor that I'm about to partake in, or that I am partaking in, and getting beat at practice is actually okay. You know, it's healthy, and hey, you know, if you're training with some of the best people in the country on a daily basis, you're a lot more confident on race day because you know, hey, I can run with these people. I run with people like this every day.
Yeah, it's the all ships rising tide.
That's right.
Philosophy.
That's right.
Which I really like. Okay, so you obviously, going back to what we're saying with you retiring from athletics, getting involved in running through the stores, coming here and setting up the squad in Northern Arizona. I was just keen to find out partly what drove you. A lot of athletes struggle when they finish, and you seem like you're quite driven and focused to have ended up doing what you've done. But then also, what lessons from your athletics career have helped you transfer to the position you're in today? Because athletes often, they retire and they wonder what next, and it feels like you didn't have too much what next.
Well, I was very fortunate in that I had an overlap. So I started my running stores. We opened our doors in August of 2006, and I was still running at a pretty good level. Now, you have to understand, I was never a true professional in the sense that I never made all of my living off of my running. I did make money running, but not that much. And so I would consider more myself more of a semi-pro. But when I opened my stores, I was still running. I still ran in the Olympic trials the next year. I still ran a couple of pretty good road races, some pretty decent times. And I think I sort of was able to slowly place less and less emphasis on my running and more emphasis on my business. And my business was so fulfilling and rewarding that it made leaving the sport easier. Still not completely easy, but there was an overlap, whereas the true professional athlete doesn't get that. In most cases, they have to be completely dedicated to their running, and then they have to retire, and then they have to figure out what to do next. That's hard. I don't envy that. I think that would be very, very difficult, and I do empathize with that situation.
What in particular, if there's one or two things that you've kind of done as a coach now, do you think, and this is the second part of the question, has transferred from your sporting background into your coaching and running NAS now?
Well, I certainly know about failure. I failed plenty of times, so I know how they feel when it doesn't go well. I they're a lot better than me, the people I coach, but I think I was good enough that I do know how they react to certain work, certain type of work, particularly athletes that are pretty physiologically similar to what I kind of was. And I think that helps. And I do understand their mindset, because even though I wasn't as fast as some of them, I absolutely was as passionate. So I do know how much they care. And I do know how much it means to them. And I take that responsibility seriously. It's probably the hardest part of being a coach, actually, is the weight on your shoulders that you feel sort of being entrusted with the hopes and dreams of these 12 to 15 athletes, because it's a tremendous amount. It's a very heavy cross to bear, because you do feel that pressure, and it's an honor that they trust you, but it is a tremendous amount of it's a really interesting job in that way, because there aren't that many jobs where someone else's hopes and dreams are based on so heavily based on what you're doing with them, you know. And so I mean, I feel that, of course, but again, I it helps that I was an athlete, because I do know what it means, and I know the things that helped me, and I know the things that didn't. And so if anything, I can kind of help them when they're feeling a little bit down, because I joked about it, but it's true. That's a big important piece, is to help them through the tough times. It's kind of easy when everything's going well. It's the tough times that where you really have to earn your keep as a coach.
And it comes back to what you were saying. At the end of the day, you can take them so far. They have to cross the white line and perform, and you need them to be at a level of their own confidence that they'll take everything that you've given and then execute it or not.
That's right.
And live with the consequences.
Yeah.
But it's a tension, isn't it? Because as much as you want them to have that enormous self-belief, have the bank of skills they can use when times are tough in a race or a competition, that you let go of the hand and it's up to them ultimately to do
it. Yeah, that part's tough too. That not having control is tough. But you have to deal with it. You have to accept that, hey, all you can do is, as a coach, just like all they can do as an athlete, is the best you can do. And as a coach, the best you can do is give them the best training you think you can. Try to understand what makes them tick physiologically, mentally, and send them to the line ready to go. And then they have to do it. You know, they have to do it. I think some coaches get a little bit overly involved in race day and overly involved in the race itself. But look, that's their time to shine, not yours. You're a spectator at that point, pretty much. I saw Mark Wetmore from the University of Colorado say that one time, because he's not super, super animated on the track or on the cross country course, and he says that it's my job is over at this point. It's their job now.
Yeah, very much how it works for me as a sports psych as well. You give them all the gifts, and they've got to use them. And the crucial thing in my world that we see is you can have all these different tools, and you can know how to use them. It's using them at the right time in the right situation.
That's right.
Yes, that's the hardest bit. Okay, so British athlete and coach, Ewan Cameron, and he asks if you have any standout occasions. This is kind of in the same ballpark as what we're just saying. Where as a coach, you've made a mental breakthrough for an athlete, or you've made with them a mental breakthrough that's then led to a performance breakthrough.
Sure, I'd like to believe that. Let me think of a good example. Well, there was an athlete on our team, Danny Shanahan, who was a pretty good collegiate athlete, but not the top. You know, not an NCAA champion, not an NCAA All-American even. Hmm. And she joined our team in the summer of 2018 in a class of recruits that was pretty good. And she kind of struggled her first couple of years here, kind of finding her place and really believing that she belonged. But in the fall of 2020, we kind of had a pretty serious conversation about, hey, it's time. It's time to step up. It's time to do the workouts with Steph, with Kellen, with the other top athletes on the team. Lauren Paquette and Alice and Alphine and just believe. And I'm not going to give you different workouts anymore. You're working out with them now. It was the crux of the conversation. And if you do, you're going to get really fit. And then you're going to perform because you have to, because it's your job. It was kind of tough love, but it really worked quite well. I mean, she ran an enormous personal best at 10,000 meters that fall, 31:22. Her previous best was 32:22. So she improved 60 seconds and ran a world championship standard, Olympic standard, in the 10,000, which is a really hard event. And you know, I was very proud of that, because it's not easy to sit down with an athlete and be super honest like that, because it's kind of tough to hear sometimes, and you want to people please. But it's not always your job to be their friend. It's not always your job to tell them what you think they want to hear. You have to tell them what you think they need to hear. And look, you know, that conversation can go two different ways, and it has gone two different ways for me before. There's other athletes that I've been really honest with them, and I think they never got over it, and I think, you know, eventually left, and it wasn't for them, or I wasn't the right coach for them because they didn't want to hear it. And that's okay, but I still think I did them a favor, and I still think I did myself a favor, because if I'm not being honest, if I can't be honest with you, then we're not going to have a good relationship, and I got to be able to be honest. And so, yeah, I'm proud of that one. You know, this is somewhat in the same genre, but when Kellen Taylor didn't finish the Boston Marathon in 2018 because of the nasty weather, that was the cold, rainy, windy year.
That's London, yeah.
When she got done with that race, she really wanted to make a rash decision. She wanted to race the next weekend somewhere in a half marathon and take advantage of the fitness. And it, you know, I was able to, and it, look, I could have got caught up in that. I could have said, oh yeah, let's do it. I said, no, it's not the right decision. This was a mental and physical grind, this whole segment. And this race was a, you know, kind of a traumatic incident, you know, to not be able to finish this race when you were this fit. You need to take a vacation. You need to take an easy week. You need to get away. And then we'll come back and we'll find something that makes sense. And we gave it a few days. And then we found the Grandma's Marathon, which was coming up in 60 days or so, which gave us some time to reset. Yes, we could still use the fitness, but but it was long enough to kind of get over Boston. Mm. And sure enough, then she went to Grandma's and ran 2:24, which was enormous PB and course record, and really still to this day one of her best races of all time. And so, you know, did that allow for a mental breakthrough? Not necessarily. She was already mentally where she needed to be, but it sort of taught her, and I think her and I have been really good ever since, about making smart decisions and how those pragmatic, you know, non-emotional decisions can lead to wonderful performances.
Great stuff, great stuff. I'm actually working with athletes and sort of anyone in your bubble that you work with now. I've seen the kind of support that these athletes can get, the kind of support that when you were a young athlete you weren't getting. And I know that you've said that you've got an expectation that athletes that come to you have to have a level of self-belief within themselves before they can start working together, because if that's not there, your job's going to be just impossible. But is there any minimum expectation, once you've got an athlete on squad, of what kind of psych work they should be doing, or should they even be doing it? Like in a way that we would say with nutritional strength and conditioning, you need to be eating this kind of food and you need to do X amount of sessions in a week. Is there a requirement for what the minimum is that your athletes do from the sports psych perspective?
Well, the bare minimum is we meet every week as a group and have what we call a focus session, or what our mental sports performance specialist calls a focus session. Her name is Shannon Thompson, and she works with a number of high-level athletes here in Flagstaff, including the NAU cross-country and track teams.
Yep.
And they've been wonderful. They've had tremendous success. When we meet as a team, she takes us through a lesson. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes it involves strategies for coping with difficult situations. Mm-hmm. Difficult situations on a micro level in a race, but also some of the difficult topics that runners face, dealing with self-worth and how they feel about themselves because of their performances. So some macro kind of things like that. And then we end with a meditation of some kind where we really relax, which I think is important to do as often as possible. And oftentimes it is just 3 minutes of total relaxation, not letting any thoughts creep in your mind. When they do, throwing them down the thought river and getting rid of them and total relaxation. And so I guess that's the bare minimum, but you know, you're always working on your mental game. I think ideally they're taking those lessons, applying them in practice, applying them in races, and then there's just the little sports psych lessons that happen between coach athlete all the time. You know, just the in a conversation in the car, a conversation after practice, just getting them to believe. I mean, that's really our biggest job as a coach, is getting them to believe in themselves. I know I said, and you reiterated that you know, you have to have that belief when you come here, but that doesn't mean that it lasts forever.
No.
It wanes, it ebbs, it flows. Yes, I want people that have that trait, but I don't expect it to be there 24/7, 365 days a year. And it's my job as a coach, and it's Shannon's job as our sports psych to make sure that you know, when they're in one of those negative ebbs, that we get them out of it and we get them back where they need to be, believing in themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So that's good to know. And I guess for some athletes who might not have ever done this kind of work before, part of it is when they first come on squad, educating them about like these are the kind of sessions we run, this is the support you can get, this is how we can help you implement it. And hopefully if they're open-minded enough to take that on board, then they're like going in and practicing and rehearsing.
Well, that's right. And some of the athletes then, and that's why the bare minimum is the focus session with the group, but then a lot of the athletes work with Shannon individually. And they really work on their mental game if they feel like that's a part of what they need, if that's a missing piece for them. And for some people, it's been quite successful.
Yeah, and that's why I always call my work, like Duncan Simpson at Barry University and the IMG Institute, mental conditioning, because everyone comes into it with different levels. And some people have got their game locked down. They don't even know that they're doing their mental game so well. It's just second nature to
them. That's right.
And other people may not be either as confident or have other things that are going on, stress outside. You know, they might be perfectly confident in their running life, but they've got loads of other things going on elsewhere.
Yeah.
And it's just about knowing how what your recipe is that works for you.
Yeah.
And that's why it's such a difficult kind of area. But it's conditioning rather than...
That's right.
Absolutely. Are there common traps you find your runners falling into that impinge on their performance? And I guess what I'm trying to ask here is like common psychological running traps that you're frequently thinking, oh, here we go again.
Yeah, the thing I see the most is imagining the perfect scenario.
Mm.
You know, what I said that Shannon does really well is she focuses on these micro things that you know are going to happen during a race. You know there's going to be a rough patch. How are you going to deal with that rough patch? And I think those are really good lessons for us to learn, because left to their own devices when it comes to the mental game, I think athletes tend to picture this wonderful experience, and you go to the line and you feel like $1 million and the race goes and you're hitting the exact splits that you imagined and your body feels great and you're beating people and you're controlling everything. Whereas in fact, we know that most times you don't feel like $1 million. Those things happen occasionally, those races happen occasionally, but most times you just feel normal. Mm. Or even a little bad sometimes. And you can't control everything. There's a lot of things that you cannot control. You cannot control how fit your competitors are. You cannot control the weather. You cannot control, you know, the field. You don't know how many people are going to be fit, how many people aren't. So the depth of the field you can't control. There's all these things. And if you only pictured this rosy view with this wonderful outcome and in fact got really fixated on that outcome, that's the biggest mistake. I think it's healthier to go into a race a little bit open-minded or curious, as Shannon says, about the possibilities, as opposed to fixated on a certain outcome. To me, the outcome should be the result of a great process.
Yeah.
And not only the training and all the ancillary things that you do leading up to the race, of course that's part of the process, but the race itself should be viewed as a process. There's all sorts of things that happen during the course of a race. That's a process in and of itself.
Mm.
And that outcome at the end of the race as a result of that process. And you know, I think we need to be a little bit more comprehensive in our analysis of a race. You know, in every other sport, just about, there's an analysis after a game, win or lose. A football team, and I mean football as in soccer, a football team doesn't win 1-0 and say, well, great, see you next time, we won. They look at it, and I bet that there's going to be a lot of things that manager highlights on the video and says, we didn't do this well, we didn't do this well, and we didn't do this well. Same thing if they lose. They're not just, it's not a total loss. They're going to point out things that they did well and that they're going to do again next time. And then, of course, they're going to point out things that they didn't do well. But somehow in running, we tend to think either I ran the time I wanted to or I didn't. Either I finished in the place I wanted to or I didn't. When in fact, it should be just like football. You could run the time you wanted to, but still acknowledge that you made mistakes. You could run slower than you wanted to, but you should still be able to acknowledge that you did some things well. And I think that's probably the biggest mistake runners make, is they just get too outcome-based and they grade themselves pass-fail.
Mm.
And I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, and one of the phrases I use from Scott all the time with my athletes is throwing a pity party.
Oh yes.
And I always say, look,
you know when they throw it, when the outcome that they were so fixated on has left them, when it's not going to be possible, that's when they throw the pity party. But they never should have been so fixed on that outcome in the first place.
Yeah, and you know, you can, I, if someone genuinely feels that they're aggrieved with their result and the whatever you say as a coach or a psychologist, I say, look, you can have your pity party, give it a day. But then you've got to come back to work.
That's right.
And even if you win, I want you to soak in that win. I want you to soak in the performance.
Yeah.
Take all the good stuff from it, and then we get ready to go again on Monday.
Yeah.
So not getting, it's like the, you know, not getting too carried away one way, not getting carried away too much the other.
Well,
and seeing the true line and seeing the progress.
Totally, because you know, I think we think sometimes that, oh, if I run this time, I'm going to be so happy. It's like you hear people, oh, if I win the lottery, I would be so happy. But then they win the lottery and they're not happy because money isn't everything. And just neither is a time, you know, neither is a BQ, whatever the time may be. Neither is a world championship qualifier for the pros, right? You think it's going to make you so happy, but you're still the same person, you know, you're still the same. And you cannot attach your self-worth to this arbitrary outcome. I think of it this way. Let's say an average runner, let's say a 4-hour marathoner finishes London, and you see the picture and they've got their arms out wide and they're smiling ear to ear and they couldn't be happier. It's not because of the last 4 hours. That's part of it. But it's the last 4 months. It's the whole process. That's what they're so proud of. Not the race itself. And I just think, yes, let's be more, let's understand the comprehensive nature of this whole running thing.
Cool. Indeed, that is my way of thinking as well. Okay, so finally, one of the things that I'm looking to just check with you is around this idea of exactly what we're talking here, challenge and pressure, and how, from your experience working with the athletes that you've got here, I'm presuming that they're very upskilled in being able to handle challenge better than maybe when before they came to the team, if everything's worked out well. But for those people listening who are, you know, the kind of runner you're describing there, someone who's, you know, dedicated to the training, does all the work, they're, you know, dare I say, middle of the pack kind of runners, and in the spirit of your book with Matt, what advice can you give as a coach to help people embrace challenge and pressure rather than buckle from it?
Yeah, I mean, it is an enormous challenge to handle the pressure of big goals and dreams. And that's okay. I think the first step is probably acknowledging that, hey, this is going to be really hard, and I'm going to embrace that as I begin this journey toward trying to set a marathon personal best, or a half marathon personal best, or whatever it is. I think embracing that it's going to be hard in all sorts of ways, physically, mentally. You know, it's not going to be easy to get out the door every day. It's not going to be, you're not going to have a runner's high every day. There's going to be a lot of days that are a grind. I think embracing that grind, embracing that, hey, those hard days are actually the best part. That's why that person has his arms out or her arms out when they cross the line, because of those days that it was snowy out or rainy or windy and they didn't want to do it and they were tired from work and they went out anyway. Those are the champion days. That's what makes you a champion. Mm. That's why you're going to run your best. The days where you have a full day off and you have all day to prepare and you have a great workout, those are fine and those are really fun. But honestly, it's the grindy days that are the best. So I think, you know, getting them to wrap their mind around being excited about that part of it is huge, because it will help them down the road. Because look, the challenges you face on race day are actually, in a lot of ways, not as hard as some of the things you face in practice. And so if you can win those little battles along the way, it's going to make that final battle a lot easier to win. And, you know, I just think it takes time, and cut yourself some slack too sometimes. Not in terms of getting out the door. You got to get out the door. Mm. But cut yourself some slack if one workout doesn't go well. You know, cut yourself some slack if 1 week you missed your mileage goal by 5 miles. You know, it's okay. I think you're gonna miss some shots, and that's all right. So I just think having a really balanced approach and a really healthy approach to it, and whatever that means for you, is probably the best way to handle the pressure. Because if along the way you let yourself get too down about the little things, the one workout that didn't go well, the 1 week where you didn't get as many miles as you wanted, those things add up in a negative way, and the pressure builds. Whereas if you handle each of those things, you cut yourself some slack on that workout that didn't go well, you get over it, you don't throw yourself the pity party, or you throw it quickly and then you move on, then along the way, you stay healthy, and the pressure doesn't build and build and build and build. And I would also say one more thing. Live in the present. Live in the present. Enjoy the work. Enjoy the workouts. Look forward to them. Take it one workout at a time, as opposed to constantly thinking about the race. I know it works for some people, but personally, I would not be the type of person that suggests, or it wouldn't work for me anyway, and maybe it will for others, but I wouldn't suggest constantly thinking about the race. I would try my best when the race enters my mind to throw it down that thought river and leave it for later and just focus on the next workout. I think that's the healthiest way. And then the time goes by quicker that way too.
Yeah. So if that piece of wisdom and guidance is helpful, there's much, much more in the new book written with Matt Fitzgerald. Run Like a Pro.
Run Like a Pro, Even If You're Slow.
Which is available from all good bookstores. Ben, where can listeners find you if they want to engage with the NAZ North Arizona Elite?
Yeah, so the team can be found on social media @NAZ_Elite. So that's Twitter and Instagram. You can find us online at NAZElite.com. The website has a plethora of information that goes back 8-9 years, videos and training logs and race recaps and pictures and all sorts of good things, records, highlights, etc. You can find me at BenRosario1 on Twitter or at CoachBenRosario1 on Instagram. And all of our athletes are easy to find online. They all are on social media and sharing, and I think they're good follows. So, yeah. Follow them.
There you go. So all that leaves me to do is to thank Ben for his time today. And he's actually come all the way back from California to not just do this interview. He's come back home, but he's come in just on time for this. So I really appreciate the efforts you've made. So thanks.
Oh, yeah, no problem. It was fun and appreciated. And thanks for having me on.
No problem. Many thanks, Ben.
Okay.